Session number 3901, rail number 3.
Rail 3. Will you describe the creation of the Association of Cine Technicians?
I wasn't involved immediately in this, but I think it did happen in 1930. It might have been late 1932 or early 1933. It started at Shepherd's Bush. There was a lot of unrest amongst the technicians at Shepherd's Bush, and they felt that they should form a society. I won't say any more than that at the moment. Somebody produced a character called Captain Matthew Cope, who said he would be agreeable to be the secretary of the society. And I can't remember now, but obviously, as I had worked at the Bush, I was a contact. I was contacted at Ealing. Arthur Graham, who also was in Army Film Unit, he was working at BIP. I don't know if he'd worked at Shepherd's Bush or not, but anyway, he was a contact. Arthur Graham, I think, was responsible for organising what was to become the Association of Cine Technicians up at BIP Elstree. I was involved in organising ACT at Ealing Studios. I must have, from that position at Ealing Studios, I went on to the council or the committee that eventually ran ACT with this character, Captain Matthew Cope. He'd had something to do with the Assyrians. Exactly what, I never knew. But I know that when we had an office in Shaftesbury Avenue, I forgot, something mentions it was somewhere near the Café de Paris, I think, just round the corner from Café de Paris. Various characters used to float in who were Assyrians. There was Marsha Moon or some name like that. I can always remember this. You were never sure if you were dealing with the film business or if you were dealing about the Assyrians' problems. There was a certain amount of disquiet in the way that Cope was handling things. And, as it were, there was a Palace Revolution, which I wasn't in on at all. And Cope was kind of dismissed, and George Elvin, who was waiting outside, I think this meeting took place in the Intrepid Fox in Wardour Street, in the upstairs room, I think. And George Elvin, who was waiting outside, was wheeled in and became the General Secretary. I became the treasurer of ACT for a period. Why they picked on me for as treasurer, because I've never been very good at arithmetic. However, I did my duty and was the treasurer of ACT, I think, for a year, 2 years, I'm not sure. That's my early, you know, early experience in ACT, and I remained on the council in one capacity or another right the way through until after the war. For a period during the war, I was unofficially the official forces representative or the army representative on ACT.
Can you describe unofficially?
Well, I mean, I think it was quite illegal for me to have been on it, so that's why I say I was the official unofficial representative of the army on the union.
What were the initial aims of the union when it set up?
Well, this was very vague. At one time, they were going to have they were thinking of a royal charter, and there was. They had a president. Now he was a Tory MP, Sir Michael Banks, I think his name was. But then some of us felt that not only, you know, this was fine to have a learned society, but we did want to regulate our working conditions. Especially financially, there was a great debate about this. And I had a brother who, well, I have a brother who was at that time a barrister, and in fact was a trade union. Worked for trade unions, and we asked him to come and explain to the council what the advantages were of being a trade union, or if you like, as opposed to a learned society, and what the advantages of being a learned society as opposed to a trade union were. And I remember he asked the council the leading question: do you wish to regulate conditions of work? And of course everybody said yes, but of course. And he said, well, you have no alternative but to become a trade union. Anyway, I think we lost quite a few members of the original council over this, or committee over this, but, you know, they ultimately all came back. Sir Michael Banks wasn't president, he was the patron, that was right. It was to be a patron, he was a patron, not president. And for a long time, we were looking for a president, and Tony Asquith said he would be the president, and he was our first president, and probably the best one we've ever had. Actually, he was very good. I mean, even if he disagreed, he would still speak with authority for the union. He was very good.
Did you have any success in the union during the early years?
Well, yes, I suppose so. Things did improve a little, marginally. I think we started to make big improvements, actually, somewhere around about 1938. 39, we ultimately managed to persuade the employers to pay overtime after 60 hours to people whose salary were below a certain figure. I can't remember what the figure was. I suppose that, in a way, was quite a victory. We also managed to persuade the management to say that if they were going to work late, they didn't suddenly say to you at 7 o'clock, all right, we're breaking for supper now, and that would be the first you knew that you were going to work late. They would at least tell you at tea time, so that if you had a telephone, you could telephone home and say, well, I won't be home for supper, or I will be home for supper, which was quite something. And we also managed, I th- I think that when we worked on a then when we worked on a Sunday, we did would get paid for it, but at straight time, I think it was one day's pay. Again, only for people below a certain sum. We hadn't been able to fix any minimum wages at all. The only gains we'd had would have been on this business of a 60-hour week, and after you'd worked 60 hours, you were then paid at straight time. And also the business of being told that you were going to work late at a reasonable hour. And then, of course, after the war, things changed enormously.
Were employers reluctant to employ union members during the 1930s?
Obviously, if you were if you've been very active and you were well known as an activist, it was difficult. It was extremely difficult. I mean, I know that I was put in to jobs by the union to find out what was going on. But these were on fringe companies whom we were highly suspicious of. And, as a matter of fact, on one of them, an incredible character, a man called Widgie Newman, I became, his very old friend, and I had never had any complaint. I mean, he always paid me. He would strike a hard bargain and say, well, if I'm going to do this film in 5 days, this would be a two reel or something like that. But if we finish in four, I'll give you a bonus. And you knew jolly well you were going to finish in four, and you always got your bonus. So why did it? I never knew. But I was used by the union on certain fringe companies to find out what was going on. And on one or two occasions, I mean, I took instructions from the union because they were, fly-by-nights. I worked with one company who had no money, none at all. They'd spent a lot of money too, but they had no money to pay the technicians. It was always they were going away tomorrow. This was one of the John Paddy Carstairs who was in the naval film unit. He and I were on this film together. And it was called. It was going to be called the Barb of Great Bayou, I think. And Paddy and I christened it in the Not Tonight Josephine Productions, because it was on one night, be off the next night, on the next night. But we never went away, and I think for 3 weeks this went on.
Were you a member of any political party during the 1930s?
Yes, I was. Yes, I was. I was a member of the Communist Party.
When had you joined?
I'm not really sure. 34, 35? Maybe 36? I'm not sure. Not sure.
Were you interested in politics outside Britain?
Well, yes, because politics affects one's own country, no matter, international politics affects anyone's country. It all rubs off. One was interested. And I suppose, to a certain extent, I suppose we would, maybe arrogant, we were very aware what was going on. We were very aware that the British public was being hoodwinked, completely aware. And my experience in Spain made it even more apparent.
In England, had you taken part in demonstrations against the British Union of Fascists?
No. I suppose I'm one of these people who doesn't like being hurt, physically hurt. I suppose in that respect I'm a coward. And so no, I hadn't.
What was your activity?
Well, I was concentrating on union affairs, you see. That was really my main activity, was union affairs.
Such areas as increasing membership?
Oh, Lord, yes. I mean, all the time we were driving, you know, striving and driving for new members. I can remember in 1939 when I went to work down at Denham on a film called The Arsenal Murder Mystery, the continuity girl who, in fact, was in AKS, Tilly Day, who's a renowned continuity girl, a wonderful person, she announced that she wasn't a member of the union. And jokingly, she said to me, because I said, well, you must be. So jokingly, she said to me, well, if you get me my back Sunday pay, I'll become a member. So I thought, you know, I knew she was joking, but I thought, well, it's the last thing I'll do. I'll get her a back Sunday pay, and I did. And so she became a member anyway, but that's what she said.
Did you have many members in the film industry?
Well, ACT.
Did you have many communist members?
No, I don't think so. 30, 40, don't know. I'm not sure about numbers.
You went to Russia, I believe, as a member of the ACT delegation.
That's right.
1937.
Yes. Thorold Dickinson and I. Thorold Dickinson, he also AKS, I think. He and I went to represent in ACT. We were both out of work, so we were in no hurry to get back. Unfortunately, the rest of the British delegation had jobs, and so, you know, the limit was 3 weeks. But I mean, I'm sure we could have stayed for 6 weeks if we wanted to. But
how did you travel there?
We went by boat. We were the first UK Russia boat of the season, which, you know, that was fabulous, actually. That lovely. Remember going through the Kiel Canal and into the Baltic with the pack ice still floating around. That's very quite exciting. Then by train to Moscow. We then went down to Kharkov. No, Kiev, that's right, down to Kiev. Then down to Sevastopol. Into the Crimea, and then back to Kharkov, and then back to Moscow, and then into Leningrad. So we saw quite a lot.
What were you visiting in these cities?
Obviously, Thorold Dickinson and I, where we could, we'd go to the studios or polytechnics or whatever. Otherwise, we did the normal routine visits, you know, hospitals, factories. We saw the great Dnieper Dam, all these kind of things, and the cultural activities, you know, the operas and theatre and things like this.
Were you impressed by what you saw?
Oh, yes, very. Particularly the studios, vast places, enormous place, the Mosfilm studio, incredible studio. We met Eisenstein, and, which was quite something. I believe we also met Podovkin. We met Alexander Rum. We met younger technicians as well, which was quite impressive. The film school, which is now that was really something. I mean, they're training there. There's a basic training first. Although the man's going to be a cameraman, he gets a basic training. If he's going to be a director, he gets a basic training. It's so that everybody gets some knowledge of the other side, which is quite special. Oh, one of the first things that I remember about the film industry, in fact, of Russia, the arrival of the boat with the delegates was filmed by a woman, cameraman. It was the first time I've ever seen it. Of course, we were quite impressed to see that happen.
The Russian directors who you mentioned, were they working on films or did you meet them on a formal occasion?
Now, Podovkin was, he was in the cutting rooms, actually. I think it was Podovkin who was in the cutting room. I'm fairly sure it was. Because, you know, he was surrounded with films, so it was as one would visualize, you know, a director being surrounded by film, and here he was, surrounded by film. In a way it was entertaining because, you know, you've already conjured up how probably you reckon he might be, and there he was just like it. He was surrounded by film around his neck and everything. So this gave us amusement. It was very impressive. The studios are incredible studios. Incredible.
Had you seen any Russian films yourself when you were in Britain?
Oh, yes.
Where did you see them?
Well, I suppose it was very difficult to see them other than the London Film Society. Then one did start to see the odd ones here and there. Now it's kind of, a common occurrence to see Russian films, I suppose, now. Although I haven't seen any for some little while now.
What did you do after your return to Britain, after your visit to Russia in May 1937?
Well, the BBC offered me a job, but didn't want to use money as a means of barter. However, I was asked to photograph a television demonstration film for the BBC, which was to be used for morning transmissions when there wasn't any normal television service transmission to the public, so that traders could at least demonstrate what television looked like. I'm not quite sure if I was employed by the BBC or if I was employed by Stull Studios to photograph this film. But we did use Stull Studios for making the film. The director was a man called Dallas Bauer, whom I had known early days of Stull's as the sound recordist, the enlightened sound recordist in the early days. And he'd asked me if I would photograph it, as I had quite a close relationship with him. He was one of the senior television drama producers of the BBC service. This film was a hodgepodge of little bits and pieces. There was small sections of Shauna Casey's play. Plough and Stars, I think it was. There was Nina May McKinney singing one of the songs that she'd made famous in the Blackbird's Review. There was Horeb Balisha, the Balisha crossing man, talking about Balisha crossings. All kinds of persons. The zoo man, Seth Smith. Johnny. I forgot, a coloured dancer, Carol Gibbons they had, Mutz Greenbaum, who was the conductor of the television orchestra. We had section on with him. We had Sidonie Goossens playing her harp, Ida Handel, I think it was Ida Handel, the violinist. As I say, it was a complete mixture of all kinds of things.
Was there any external location?
Yeah, we did little, I think, but not very much, because in those days, you see, television OBs was very much in its infancy, I suppose there was some, but I quite honestly I can't remember.
OB is outside broadcast.
Outside broadcast, yes. I can't honestly remember. I'm not sure. Not sure.
Were there any problems filming the subjects you mentioned?
Well, the great thing in those days, there was a television didn't like high contrast at all, and working with the intermediate film process that I'd used with Baird's, I knew how to, if you like, expose so that it was low contrast, really. It didn't like excessive contrast, and so one went for low contrast. In other words, white, light grey, and grey, no blacks. And I knew how to do it, so that's why I suppose I was the cameraman. Also, of course, I had this relationship with Dallas Barnard.
How did you film The Coloured Dancer?
Oh, well, that's fair enough. They're not that black. Also, most of the backgrounds. In fact, we never had black backgrounds. We had grey backgrounds.
What did you do after that?
After that, I went to Spain with a group led by Ivor Montague. He had a company called Progressive Films, and we were going to make three films. One was going to be called Spanish ABC, the other one was Behind the Spanish Lines. I've forgotten what the third one was. However, because of the situation at the front, the obvious advance of the fascist forces, which was going to cut the road to Madrid, ultimately the unit decided to finish with making just the two films that they'd made, and they returned to England, leaving me behind with a camera and what film was left to provide newsreel coverage, which was to be offered to the English newsreels. That, in fact, never got placed. It was seen by the newsreels, but never accepted.